Yes, we are getting vaccinated, and yes, we are going to open up. And because of that, federal government COVID disaster payments will begin to reduce once we reach the double vaccination milestones of 70% and then 80%. Some have criticised this move as being preemptive, claiming that the economy won't be full steam ahead for some time. But the Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, says the federal government is supporting around 1.5 million people, costing $1 billion every week, and that can't go on forever. I'm keen to hear your thoughts on this issue, especially if you have been receiving COVID disaster payments. If you've been receiving any kind of support in that form or measure, how do you feel about them reducing and then at 80% being phased out altogether? You can get in touch via our ABC Radio National Facebook page. We're talking about the phasing out of COVID disaster payments. Professor Carla Treloar is the Director of the Centre for Social Research in Health and the Social Policy Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. And Carla, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning. Thanks very much for your interest in this.
Carla, can you take us through how the disaster payments have worked in 2021 and who's actually been eligible for those payments?
Yeah, the 2021 payments are quite different to last year, and the eligibility is much more stringent. So as we all were living in earlier this year, we were enjoying some greater freedoms, and then we saw the creeping of the Delta wave. And so there were new COVID disaster payments put in place to assist those who had lost work. But the difference in 2021 was that those eligibility requirements meant that people needed to have lost work during a current lockdown. So if someone had been in the unfortunate position of losing their job or their hours in March or April, they were not eligible for the payments that were instituted in the middle of the year. So in our analysis, we've shown that in the lockdown areas, there were about 900,000 people who were receiving these lowest rates of income support, like job seeker, youth allowance, parenting payments. But of those 900 plus thousand people, there was a smaller amount who actually received those payments. Just 17% of people received them. So, you know, about 85% didn't receive those payments.
Which I think in your analysis ended up being around about 116,000 people?
Yeah, that's right. And our Social Policy Research Centre has been working with ACOS over the longer period to look at trends in poverty and inequality. And we've just done a sharper focus on the very short-term impact of COVID over from 2019 through to just last month, and particularly focused on two variables, if you like, those people who are relying on the lowest support payments and areas of pre-existing disadvantage prior to the pandemic. And when we look at those increases in the numbers of people receiving the lowest payments, they're not equally spread across the country, and they're greatest in areas that were experiencing disadvantage pre-pandemic.
I want to come to more of that analysis you've discovered through your study and research in just a moment, Carla. But just before we get to that, just to explain to people, what has Josh Frydenberg outlined will happen to the level of payments when we reach 70% double vaccination in some states and territories, and then what happens when we get to 80%?
Yeah, which is great that we're heading towards those vaccination rates, right? That's a tremendous public health bonus and benefit for the whole of the country. But it will leave some people behind and those who are doing it tough. So 70% that currently disaster payments are continuing weekly, and 70% people will need to be applying each week. At 80%, the payment drops in the first week. It's currently around $750 a week. It'll drop to $450 a week if people have lost more than 8 hours, or if they're on income support, it'll drop to $100 a week. Temporary visa holders will drop off completely because they're not eligible for Centrelink benefits at all.
Right.
So those 80% benefits, those benefits at 80% then disappear over a week-by-week basis, and people then need to go to the usual Centrelink application process to be on like the regular job seeker or parenting or youth allowance payments.
Well, Carla, just before we move on, let's have a listen to someone who has been dealing with this firsthand. Zoe lives in Sydney and she's been receiving the COVID disaster payments, and she recorded her thoughts for us in a voice memo.
I'm on youth allowance, which works out to be around $36 a day, meaning I live paycheck to paycheck and don't have any savings to rely on when things go wrong. It has been the $200 extra a week in disaster payments that has meant I've been able to keep afloat during this lockdown and afford simple things like food and bills and rent. However, it hasn't been enough to get me out of the debt that I accrued during the month where no supplements were available to anyone on income support, and I'm sure many people are in the same situation as I am. It seems a bit irresponsible to me to preemptively taper back payments that were delayed for so many people in the first place, especially when those people are the ones that are probably in the most precarious and uncertain situations. While I'm fortunate enough to know that my work is opening up on the 11th, I am a casual, so I haven't received any shifts and don't have any job security. And going into a post-lockdown where I don't have even the disaster payments to rely on is very scary.
Now, that's Zoe. And coming back to you, Carla Treloar, it sounds to her, to me, that Zoe does have some inklings of hope in terms of some casual shifts perhaps coming her way. And she mentioned a date of October 11th, which implies that she's living and working when she can in New South Wales, which is destined to open up on that date. Doesn't Josh Frydenberg, our Federal Treasurer, have a point here that people like Zoe can look forward to more work into the future, therefore let's start phasing out these disaster payments?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an optimist too that we will be in a recovery phase as things start to open up, but we don't know the pace of that. We don't know the coverage of that. And our analysis is particularly focused on those areas of economic disadvantage prior to the pandemic, which are doing it tough with higher rates of people on the payments like Zoe described. So those areas of disadvantage are characterised because they have pre-existing higher rates of unemployment, lower incomes, types of work that you can't do at home on Zoom. They're manual work or skilled or sales work where you have to actually be there. So we don't know how quickly those industries or opportunities are going to open up, particularly for people on casual or insecure contracts, and particularly in areas which have higher numbers of people who don't have that much money to spend pre-pandemic, and even higher rates of people on those lower income supports who have less money to spend discretionally going to their local businesses and services. This isn't something that's spread equally across the country. There are very important areas of concern with those areas that were experiencing economic disadvantage prior to the pandemic and now have greater numbers of people on those lowest income supports. To take away the supports, it feels, without understanding these patterns, is something we're trying to promote greater understanding of through the release of these data and providing them to decision makers and to organisations that are working into these areas.
If you're listening to this conversation and you've been receiving COVID disaster payments and you're concerned about your future employment as a result of these payments being wound up and perhaps being in that transition, trying to find work and worried about what the diminution of that support will mean for you, we'd very much like to hear what that will mean for your individual circumstance. Listening into this conversation with Carla Treloar and myself is Claire Victory. Claire is the National President of the St. Vincent de Paul Society. And Claire, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem at all. Claire, from St. Vincent de Paul's perspective, what impact do you foresee with the reduction of these disaster payments over time?
Well, Michael, we expect to see the same sort of impact as the decreases in income support that we've already seen. Last year, when the government introduced things like JobKeeper and the coronavirus supplement, demand for our services went right down. Because, as Zoe described, people suddenly had money to pay their rent, pay for food, and pay their bills. So they didn't need to rely on organisations like Vinnie's to the same extent that that they did previously.
Just to remind people too, Claire, as you talk about this, back in 2020, the Newstart allowance suddenly had a $550 supplement per fortnight added to it to get people through that period. And as you say, that was transformative for so many people's lives, wasn't it?
Exactly. That increase in income support did what organisations like Vinnie's have always said it would do. It helped people out. It enabled them to buy the things that they need for themselves and their families, things like food and school supplies, and that was money that was spent in the local economy. So it was really good for everyone.
But now, in contrast, in 2021, we've heard from Carla Treloar that, of course, the support payments, the COVID disaster support payments, have been less in 2021 for those people who are inside the welfare system. And also, not everyone has been eligible. In fact, far fewer people, like 17% of those people compared to 2020, have been eligible for those payments. So what have you seen in terms of demand for your services, your food hampers, your social support, your housing support in 2021 compared to the year before?
So demand has definitely been increasing, particularly for things like food. You mentioned food hamper, and we do have volunteers around the country assisting people in that way. And we've seen an increase, particularly in areas such as Southwest Sydney. Again, as Carla described, people who are already facing high levels of disadvantage have been greatly impacted through the pandemic. And so we're seeing a real increase in need for food support and also people needing help with housing, a number of them needing that help for the first time because of the effects of the pandemic.
It's been claimed, Claire, often by government at a federal level, that if an income support system is too generous for too long, it creates a disincentive for people to go out and actively look for work. Are you a supporter of that argument?
No, I find describing our income support system as generous as quite inaccurate and offensive, really. You heard Zoe describe what it is like existing on our income support system. She said $36 a day. For some payments, it's about $45 a day. That's not a lot of money. And you don't encourage people to get into work by making life difficult for them and punishing them for their poverty. You need to have appropriate structures and support systems in place. People don't, you know, they're not out of work because we've got some generous income support system. That is just not the case. And we really encourage government to actually listen to the lived experience of people and actually pay attention to the data, like that which Carla has presented today, to see what is actually happening and what the real situation is and the real reasons that people are in poverty and disadvantage.
Carla Treloar, can I come back to you on this? Because one of the arguments expressed by government is that when it comes to the phasing out of these disaster support payments, the COVID disaster support payments across those areas that reach 70% double vaccination and then 80% where it's phased out altogether, is that businesses are reopening, that local businesses within CBDs will start to thrive. The job ads are still healthy even now. Why can't we be optimistic that those people who have been doing it tough on lower incomes may find work that maybe wasn't available 18 months ago? Perhaps things are going to be okay.
It'd be great to have a crystal ball and know that for sure. But I think we also know that we might be living with the impacts of Delta for a long time, with different types of approaches to control in the future, which might include localised lockdowns if there's, you know, outbreaks in particular areas. So we can't forecast the future of work at this point. And for people who are living on whether it's $36 a day or $45 a day, it's clearly inadequate to meet the needs of everyday life, let alone travel around the city looking for work or the region looking for work, and again coming back to those areas where there were highest numbers of people needing support were in those areas which had pre-existing higher levels of unemployment. So it's not guaranteed that by October 11 or October 25 or whenever in New South Wales or the other areas that from that day we will bounce back to pre-existing levels. So we're suggesting a more cautious, a safe, a considerate approach to supporting people who are doing it tough and have been doing it tough for some for a long period of time without a buffer, without something to rely on or have guarantee that they can pay the rent or the mortgage next week or next month. This is a chronic stress situation for lots of people, and we know the relationships between disadvantage and health outcomes. It's a important element of this that we understand the ongoing and future costs of not investing in people doing it tough now.
And in fact, your research into this area has shown that in some key local government areas, the amount of people needing welfare support has doubled, and that seems to be occurring mostly and predominantly in areas that were already low-income areas as identified back as far as 2019.
Yes, and this is spread somewhat across the country, but in the areas that we're talking about are Western and Southwest Sydney, which are very important for controlling the New South Wales outbreak at the moment, and in Melbourne, outer Northwest and Southeast Melbourne, as well as other communities between Brisbane and the New South Wales border, far North Queensland, North Adelaide and Central Australia.
That's a vast area.
It is. It is. And that's, you know, a quirk of what of how the data can be manipulated. But there are these areas of concern, particularly because of that pre-existing disadvantage and that they're just automatically on particular dates with higher levels of unemployment to start with. We can't know that people who have lost work over this period will walk into jobs on that day, and the risk is that they miss out on any income support if they're forced to move from an automatic payment to application through Centrelink with delays in or gaps in processing, or just not being aware of that change, because we're all faced with multitudes of information coming at us each day around what COVID is and how to manage it. We risk leaving people behind when we really should be, as has been said before, we really should be all in this together, and we're not. There are particular areas of disadvantage that we should be paying attention to.
Well, Carla Treloar, Claire Victory, I'd like to play, if I may, another account of life on the COVID disaster payments. And this one comes from Jack. And Jack works in hospitality in Melbourne.
I work in hospitality, so as you can imagine, me and my co-workers feel the effects of lockdowns pretty sharply, and we all lose quite a few hours each. However, when we went into the last two lockdowns, it took a while to start receiving support. Nobody actually reached out from Centrelink to let me know that the disaster payments were an available service, which seemed weird to me because I was already on their systems. It also didn't cover all of the weeks that we'd been in lockdown, which meant that I was having to dip into my small amount of savings in order to cover those periods, which I'm lucky to have, but a lot of my friends don't have savings, so I know the periods can be even more stressful for them. There's also been quite a few problems with my auto payments, even though my circumstances haven't changed. Overall, I just feel like the support last year, even though it wasn't perfect, it was a little bit more available and reliable, and that meant that I was able to focus on my studies a lot more than I do alongside work, whereas this year I feel that my finances are a bit more of a distraction. And my concerns coming out of this lockdown is that if they take away the COVID disaster payments straight away, as soon as we open up, those periods can be quite uncertain. We might go back into a lockdown. There might not be enough shifts on offer. It would be good to have a little bit more support throughout those periods.
That's Jack from Melbourne. Claire Victory, can I bring you back in on this? Is Jack's experience as a younger person reflected in the kind of support being asked for from St Vincent de Paul, or do they tend to be older families? Or I'm just wondering, are younger people asking for more support these days, or is it older people generally?
Look, we do see requests for support from across the spectrum, but what I have noticed myself through this pandemic is a lot of younger people seeking assistance for the first time, people who probably never thought that they would have to access Centrelink or would never have to reach out to an organisation like Vinnie's. So certainly that story rings true, that there are people who are facing this sort of disadvantage for the first time. And that's on top of the thousands of people who were already experiencing disadvantage, as Carla has been explaining.
Yeah. Carla, just as we come to a wrap on this, as someone who's of author's report, seen the data firsthand, what are you asking for the federal government to reconsider in this regard? Because clearly they're anxious to stop spending $1 billion a week in these kind of support payments. What kind of compromise would you be suggesting that helps cater for those desperately in need whilst stopping that kind of drain on federal resources?
Yeah, I think Jack and Zoe's stories really highlight the precarious nature of employment for some people, and they can't know exactly what's going to happen week to week. So we're suggesting, rather than abolishing the disaster payments, to extend them, to give an opportunity for us to see what's going to happen with economic recovery. We're also suggesting that the very low rates of payment, Zoe mentioned $36, $45 for JobSeeker, that's lifted to somewhere near to the poverty rate. It's way below the poverty rate at the moment. So we saw that outcome in 2020 when those payments were lifted, with almost 500,000 people living out of poverty because of those payments. So the poverty rate fell last year from 11.5% to 9.5%. Lifting people out of poverty does wonders for them, for their families, and for their communities, and is an economic incentive to the local areas. Mm. We're concerned about rent assistance and ensuring that that's of an adequate level to people who might have precarious employment as we move out of COVID lockdowns. In the longer term, investing in social housing to address critical shortfalls of supply, and paying again attention to particularly groups at greatest risk, people with disability or chronic illness, single parents, by recognising the additional costs that they face managing day to day and managing the extra demands of these lockdowns.
Well, it's vital that we keep having these conversations, and I do thank both of you for giving us some very real perspective on what could happen once we reach the 70 and 80% financial cutoffs that the Federal Treasurer has announced. Professor Carla Treloar and Claire Victory, thank you both very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
Claire Victory is the National President of the St Vincent de Paul Society, Professor Carla Treloar, Professor and Director of the Centre for Social Research at the University of New South Wales, the author of this report into what happens if COVID disaster payments start to be wound back.